Before we get to anything else, let me introduce my first guest because she's on the road into St. Louis today. She'll be taking part in the White Privilege Conference that opened up yesterday, but she'll be speaking tomorrow on the UMSL campus here in St. Louis. Her name is Joy DeGruy-Leary. She's a professor of social work at Portland State University and wrote a book, and this is what she'll be talking about at the conference this weekend. The book is called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. Joy, thanks for joining me on the road into St. Louis.
Thank you.
What is post-traumatic slave syndrome?
Post-traumatic slave syndrome is basically takes a look at what the results of historical trauma is, first on the people that were experiencing it directly. In other words, looking at 1619 to the ratification of the 13th Amendment, we're looking at about 246 years of American chattel slavery. The first question and the first concern that I had looking at African-American culture and looking at what we call African-American culture is what of this culture is the result of adaptive behavior, socially learned behavior, and those things that are intrinsic to being African. And so part of what I wanted to look at was what impact did slavery have on Africans at the time? And during that time that they were impacted, and when you look at this, obviously when people hear the term, they know it's associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. It is not a clinical diagnosis, whereas post-traumatic stress disorder is. Post-traumatic slave syndrome suggests that no doubt 246 years of slavery produced injury. There's no doubt. It's not plausible for it not to have, because we're not looking at a single trauma. And we understand with things like 9/11, for example, that people were traumatized that weren't even there. People who heard about it or saw it on television or heard about loved ones that have been injured can't get on planes, some of them, to this day. So we know that a person does not have to experience a direct trauma in order to be traumatized. So taking that into account, and that, of course, this comes from the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. We know that a person can experience a traumatic response indirectly. So given that, consider 246 years of slavery. Consider rapes, being sold, tortured, beaten, bred, and everything in between. We're not looking at a single trauma. We're looking at lifetimes of trauma. So we no doubt nobody would be confused that folks were injured. So the question then arises, did they get any help? That would be no, they didn't get any help, clinically or otherwise. So therefore, people developed adaptations to symptoms of injury. Children learned what they saw, what they experienced in their environment, not only their own traumas, but the behaviors of parents that were traumatized. So then folks, of course, would naturally say, yes, but that was long ago and you all were free. True indeed. So then the second question becomes, after slavery officially ended, one, was there any help then? Did anyone get any treatment? Did anybody get any support, free therapy? That would be no. The second question would be, did the trauma continue? So unlike what most people would wonder about post-traumatic slave syndrome, they go, well, gosh, that's over. Well, the trauma continued after slavery, starting with peonage, unlawful selling of slaves, debt servitude, sharecropping, convict lease, Jim Crow. So what we understand is that what followed slavery was almost a virtual re-enslavement and new and different forms of oppression. So my work basically takes a look at what of that stuff that we adapt that led to resilience. No doubt, clearly African people and African Americans are resilient. But what of those behaviors, what of those things we adapted to led to things that were not productive, things that relate to how we view ourselves, our body image, feeling about our hair texture, our facial features, beliefs about our efficacy. These become the things that become a concern to a person like me who works with communities and families and children, so that I can say, how do we then educate ourselves to undo some of the less productive behavior and begin a road to complete healing as a people? So I think that's kind of a real fast way to describe something that took many, many years to develop.
Okay, and you are the one who wrote the book on this, literally. So while you were doing your research on this and coming up with your theory on it, is part of what you're arguing that African Americans and descendants of slaves and others in this country who fall into those categories need external assistance to help the trauma dissipate?
What do you mean by external assistance?
In other words, outside of their families, outside of their immediate groups, outside of their neighborhood. In other words, do they need the assistance of a government agency? Do they need the assistance of something official to help that trauma dissipate? Or is it something that can be taken on by the community itself?
Well, I think, like anything, it has multiple levels and also multiple levels of severity. I think that it's impossible to have not been affected. I don't think, it does not result in individuals walking around with clinical diagnoses in 2006. However, there are adaptive behaviors that are with us currently. And it's not kind of hard to see that. When you look at multiple generations of Holocaust victims, say, or multiple generations of Native Americans in this country that experienced colonialism. So there are several levels. Post-traumatic slave syndrome implies a need for social justice, no doubt.
But where does that justice have to come from is my question. Are you asking for something officially to be done?
Let me be clear. When we talk about social justice, it's like anything else. We know that, hence the reason for the White Privilege Conference, is that the playing field is not level and has not been. And therefore, when I say there needs to be social justice is implied in the healing of any people that are downtrodden or any person or group of people that have been subjugated or oppressed. So that kind of goes without saying. This is not about looking outside and saying, for example, to white people, you need to help come and fix me. That's not what my work is about. Now, is there a need for this country to acknowledge what it has done, acknowledge slavery, period, which I think is not even really done even in textbooks and history. Yes, that needs to be done. Do we need curricular materials that testify to the truth of what has happened since slavery and through slavery in terms of the African experience? Not only Africans. There's not even acknowledgement of the heroes and heroines of the Civil War and or abolitionists, white or black, no acknowledgement. And I think that that's unhealthy for any country to not have a true accounting of history. So, yes, it implies that. It implies social justice in the sense that we're still looking at systems, systemic racism and institutionalized racism that impacts generations today. Yes, all of that needs to happen. But my work specifically not only suggests that social justice is implied here, but that, in fact, African Americans, whether anybody ever acknowledges that there's a need for social justice, need to take a look at themselves, look at their families, as individuals and communities, and to begin to look at what we can do to eradicate some of the injurious behavior and perspectives that are harming ourselves and our children, and hence the generations to come. So it's kind of one of those things where when people look at me, they kind of go, "Well, Joy, is this about folks, the government turning around? And is this about money? Is this about a paycheck?" This is about healing. What my work is about healing. I'm not waiting for anybody to acknowledge that that's necessary, or to suggest that I need them to determine whether or not this is something that needs to start happening. This is something that I think is an immediate issue that needs to be addressed first and foremost by black people themselves.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you next. How much of this is a grassroots African-American solution that needs to be formed?
Well, I think a huge percentage of it is a grassroots program. It's a national program. It's a national issue, an international issue. I just spoke at, for example, at Oxford University. I just got back and did a talk in London. You still have an experience of the Afro-Caribbean community. A level of injury, slavery existed for them as well, and they too, it resonates with the needs that they have, though different from those of us in the United States, very similar. And so, again, it is something that resonates from individuals within the United States and throughout the diaspora where Africans reside. So, yeah, it does need to happen on the grassroots, but I don't want to in any way presume or trivialize what I mean by grassroots. I think that's a very broad and pervasive look at what has happened to a large mass of people throughout the world.
Talking with Joy DeGruy-Leary, assistant professor at Portland State University and author of Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing, here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Joy, I know you've done a lot of work with and written quite a bit about African-American youth in this country. How is somebody who's a teenager today in an African-American family affected by all of these things that we're talking about? Several decades after the civil rights movement made giant leaps in this country, and certainly a century and a half after the official end of slavery, how is the average African-American boy or girl affected by this in their daily life?
Well, let me kind of give you an example. First of all, my research had to deal with African-American adolescent male violence. So my actual research itself, the empirical data came out of looking at 100 incarcerated youth and 100 non-incarcerated youth from the same general vicinity in Portland, Oregon. So that was some of the work that I looked at in terms of a particular population. But I want to give you some general perspective, and then I'll get specific as it relates to my research itself.
Good.
On a general level, what we understand, and again, my theory is not... I'm telling you, it's not all that unusual or deep or even new, for that matter, because we have theorists, Bandura, for example, social learning theory and vicarious learning. Do you know how to cook?
Well, let's say I do.
Okay, so how'd you learn?
Mom.
Yeah, okay. So how'd she likely learn?
Mom.
Right. Okay, so what we do know is that things that we learn are transmitted through generations. Not deep, not rocket science. Now, good things, bad things, true things, false things, healthy things, unhealthy things are passed along through families, through generations,
mm-hmm.
through modeling, through teaching, any number of things. Now, if you would consider African Americans, which often people will say, well, you know, they tend to do this or they tend to act this way. And then folks you'll hear will say, well, you know, that's their culture. Okay, that's their culture. And for me, from my vantage point, I think we can ill afford to just say that's their culture, because folded within that culture are adaptive behaviors that came about as a result of living in a hostile environment that have been passed along generation after generation. Now, things get passed along whether they're true, real, healthy or not. For example, I don't know how old you are, but I don't have a problem saying I'm near 50.
Me too.
Now, okay, there you go. When we were young, we were told, for example, if you were babysitting, I don't know if you've ever babysat a child, but if you did and you noticed anyone when we were children and we were baby, you were babysitting, when you put the baby down to sleep, which way would you lay the baby?
You know, I don't remember doing it as a babysitter. I just know it as a dad. You put the baby on their side.
Now you do, but not when we were children.
When we were children, the thinking was on their back.
No.
No?
When we were children, the thinking was on their stomach.
Okay.
And the reasons for that we were given, and the reasons that many of us were told, is that if you put the baby on their back, they'll choke.
Right.
If you put the baby, remember the little weird cat theory? There's some strange cat theory. The baby cats would smell the milk. And I mean, it just got bizarre. I mean, absolutely bizarre. And after a while, people started adding to why it was necessary to put the baby on the stomach. Well, the truth of the matter is, you know now that to put the baby on the side of the back reduces sudden infant death syndrome from 40 to 60%.
Correct.
So everything that we believed taught us something and then also gave us reasons, try to legitimize why that was true. None of it was true. So these are things that large groups of us did, and you know, in this country, even the tribes in other countries, based on false information or just what we'd seen or learned around us, which in fact was more harmful to us than anything else.
Although I don't think that was necessarily a cultural thing. That was the best medical science thinking at the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then we, people who didn't even understand the scientific context, made up reasons for it. So I'm giving you that to give you a perspective of a behavior that people can engage in, simply believing that it is the appropriate thing to do, and that it's the absolute wrong thing to do. So let me give you some perspectives of that from a cultural vantage point, okay? So now I'm going to talk about some of the things that you notice among African Americans. The first thing that I noticed that I started to hear in contemporary youth and children were statements like, Oh, he was really good looking. He was gorgeous because, you know, he had light skin. He was light-skinned. Or he had a light complexion. Therefore, he was cute. That's contemporary. We're talking 2006. Or, oh, wow, she had really good hair. Did you see how good her hair was? Meaning that the hair was straighter or wavy or curly. And these attributions are being made 2006 as to what is beautiful. And meaning that anything that is not straight or wavy or curly is bad hair. So you want to have good hair and you want to have light skin because those are the good things. Those are the positive things. And statements being made like, you black, nappy hair, da-da-da-da-da, all of the things being said attributable to what is inherently African. So these are things that I heard as a child that, unfortunately, I'm hearing now in 2006. I hear it in rap songs. It's something that has been transmitted intraculturally. This is something that black people are passing along within the culture. My question then is, why is that so? Because these are harmful things. These are negative attributions. Why are they taking that on? Why is it being transmitted? How and who is transmitting it?
All right, let me just stop you there because I would argue that the opposite of beautiful isn't bad. So if somebody thinks one thing is beautiful and the other thing isn't necessarily beautiful, that doesn't mean that the other thing is bad. But let me take a break here, Joy. Joy, hold on just 1 second because I got to take a commercial break and I want to come back and talk more about this. She will be tomorrow speaking at the White Privilege Conference on the campus of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Joy DeGruy Leary, author of Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Joy DeGruy Leary, an assistant professor at Portland State University. He's got a PhD in social work research and is the one who came up with the post-traumatic slave syndrome theory. Wrote about it in a book called America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. She's on her way into St. Louis right now to speak tomorrow at the White Privilege Conference on the UMSL campus. And before we broke, you were talking about examples of the way it's affecting African-American teenagers today, and I had to cut you off there because we had to go to the break. Did you have other examples that you wanted to get to?
Well, first of all, I want to respond to your response, which is that doesn't necessarily mean for you. Beautiful doesn't mean that if this is beautiful, then it's bad to be the other way. I want to be very clear that it's not necessarily about what you would think. It's about what African-Americans would think, and African-Americans do often, in fact, think the opposite of that is, in fact, ugly.
Okay.
If you are black and ugly, black, stupid, black, XYZ. Black is used as the very thing to assault or insult a person.
And as you were saying before, that's an intracultural thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So my point here is, for example, you have, let me give you an example that might you might kind of see or not see. Very often African Americans, and I use this example because it's pretty pervasive, and most African Americans, regardless of class, are affected by this behavior. You have, say, a black mother and a white mother. Anywhere, I mean, let's use Portland, that's where I live. Black mother and a white mother married, both have two boys. The boys know each other, they go to school together, they spend the night over each other's homes, they're good friends. Black family, white family. The black mother and a white mother find themselves one day at a school meeting, sitting next to each other, in fact. And on either side of them are their sons. The black mother leans over to the white mother and just comments. She says, "Oh, I noticed it's your son. You know, I noticed he's doing really well." And the white mother immediately bursts into a grin and says, "Yes, he is doing great. He is such the man. I mean, he is in the talented and gifted program. He won the science fair. You know, he's doing exceptionally well in his classes." And she's just so excited, exuberant, she forgets that, you know, she just completely forgets about anything. Because she's proud of her son. And she's pretty much telling you how proud she is. But then she thinks to herself, what am I thinking about? Her friend, the black mother, her son is also excelling, perhaps even more than her son is excelling. And she might say to that black mother, well, you know, wait a minute now. Hey, I've heard that your son is getting along. Why? And the next thing she hears is, oh, stop it. Oh, come on. Oh, he's just such a handful. Oh, yeah, you might think so, but oh, God, you should see him at home. He is just something else. And it's an immediate knee-jerk reaction. And a lot of white people look at that and go, gee, why are they so negative? It just seems so negative. And I mean, this is pervasive. And it's odd. I mean, it's just odd behavior. Now, some people will go, oh, is that false modesty? Well, let's look at it closely, which is what I did. And I even talked to people about it. So this wasn't, you know, just something that kind of came out of my head. But I started to look at that behavior, and I started to wonder, number one, is the black mother really proud of her son? And I think overwhelmingly 100% of black people will say, yeah, she probably is. The question then is, why isn't she saying so? Why isn't she saying, yes, he is, he's wonderful, he's great, and he did this, and he did that? Why is she saying, oh, girl, stop it, he's just a handful, oh, my goodness, you should have seen him yesterday, oh, he's just so, oh, he's a mess. Now, we've normalized the behavior to such a degree that even when I speak to audiences, black and white, they go, wow, that is true, I do notice that. I've spoken to people with PhDs, they do it too. Why do you do that? Well, let's give some perspective to that particular event. There are many answers, but here's one possible one. Imagine that during slavery in particular, you have a black mother. And imagine that that black mother has children. And a white slave master, male or female, comes through. Maybe the woman's working in the house or out in the fields, it doesn't matter where. And that black white master says to that black parent, that mother, about her son, oh, my, my. Now, that boy is really coming along. Oh, he is really coming along. What is she going to say? The likelihood is she's going to say, no, he's not. He's stupid. He can't work. All of those things, because she doesn't want him told, nor does she want them to see any favor that would remove him from her. That is called appropriate adaptation to living in a hostile environment. In other words, the denigrating comments were not because she believed he was something horrific or bad, but because she was trying to protect him. Now, we never unlearned those behaviors. Never was there a period of time that even acknowledged there was anything to unlearn throughout all of this history. And much of that became, quote, cultural behavior. So those are very simple things. I have people from all over the United States saying to me, you know what? I can't tell you how difficult and strange it was for me to feel comfortable when people praised my children or my spouse or almost anybody. I can't believe how difficult it is, but now I'm saying thank you. I mean, that's a simple thing.
All right, Joy, let me ask you, though, would that black mother react differently if she were talking to another black mother instead of to a white mother?
No. No, she would not.
How long does it take, then, for that effect, if there is such a thing, to, as I said earlier, dissipate through generation after generation after generation?
That particular one, it almost can dissipate in a conversation. That's how quickly it can turn around. That I've watched it in my work with African-American communities throughout the United States. It can dissipate when you can't fix what you don't know. You don't change behavior you think is not in need of changing. So it's not that it's going to drag along. We've never really identified those things to such a degree that we figured out, you know what, we need to stop doing this.
So part of your work is to say to people in the African-American community, hey, look, this is what we're doing, and we need to stop doing it. We need to filter out these detrimental attitudes and actions and the way we act, not only with each other, but with anybody else, and fix it, because otherwise we can't move forward as a people.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone say it as well as you just did.
And what is the reaction you get when you give these talks to African-American audiences?
Profoundly, profoundly open, excited, overwhelmingly. I will be really honest with you. It is overwhelmingly supportive, excited, participatory. I have people, I mean, literally coming out of the woodwork. It's an absolute amazing thing. Amazing.
I got to tell you, I'm glad to hear that what your work really is aiming for is to try to make some change from within, which is what I asked you early on, rather than trying to turn to an external motivator to put the blame elsewhere and say it's not our fault, it's the way they made us, as opposed to, look, it is our fault, we may have been made this way, but we're the only ones who can change it.
Well, hey, exactly.
Talking with Joy DeGruy-Leary, a professor at Portland State University and the author of the book Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. She'll be speaking tomorrow at the White Privilege Conference here in St. Louis. Joy, in the context of everything we've been talking about here, what do you think about the notion of reparations?
How come I knew that's where you were going? How come I knew that? You know, one of the things that we have to be real clear about, as it relates to the issue of slavery in America, it has never been addressed or dealt with in an appropriate way. The fact that it has not has created two different things. Very often when people look at slavery, I'm going to answer that, but it's kind of a long way. They say, you know, I wasn't there, I didn't do it. No, I didn't have anything to do with it. You know, I didn't own any slaves. I'm really tired of hearing about it. You know, it had nothing to do with me. Well, what we do know is that 246 years of unpaid labor guaranteed that the progeny of the white South would have privilege and wealth. And 246 years of unpaid labor also guaranteed that the progeny of the black African slave would have debt and have suffering. So it doesn't matter whether either of us were there. That becomes irrelevant. What does become relevant is whether or not what we see today in contemporary society as it relates to African-American people has been just and has been equitable, fair, in essence, the level playing field. And while I know we don't have time today to go over it, it's real clear that that's not the case. Surely some repair needs to be made. How that needs to happen and in what form, I'm not certain. But I am absolutely certain repair needs to be made.
All right, let me finish.
When I talk about social justice, that this is not an issue that, despite the fact, clearly I'm going to heal, I'm going to help my children to be resilient and my grandchildren, and I'm going to build issues of esteem and efficacy, that is not going to thwart systemic injustice. It's not. It's going to maybe build a person that has the ability, despite it, to survive it and even thrive. But it certainly isn't going to thwart systems that are in place that are injurious to black people.
All right, let me see how you would respond to this, because I would think that there would be no chance of actual financial remuneration when we talk about reparations ever coming. However, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep fighting for equality, and inequality, I really mean equal opportunity for everybody, regardless of their skin color. And I also think that what needs to be part of it is, and you mentioned this very quickly earlier on, is that the educational system in this country make a better acknowledgement of that part of our history that too often is glossed over and just called slavery in a larger sense, and not detailed as much, so that people really do understand it. Never excusing it in any way, but certainly talking about it and making that the real reparations that could go a long way towards helping. What do you think of that?
I agree with that. That is at the very least something that we can do, must do. And this is for all children. If you're in America, this is American history. You know what I'm saying? This is real history. So I think we do a disservice to everyone, and we perpetuate things that are not only injurious to black children, but to all children, because they don't have a proper real accounting of who people are, and to understand on whose shoulders people like myself stand.
Yep.
The strength, the struggle, the toil. You know, again, no accounting of that suggests that they were either unimportant or not valued at all.
All right, I've only got a minute to go here, but one last thing I want to ask you about. I think it's important, if the African-American community in this country is going to come to terms with it, that people like you say some of the things that you've been saying to them, which is get your act together, realize what the problems are, and move on. Very much along the same lines of people like what Bill Cosby has been saying to audiences across this country the last couple of years. I think there needs to be more of that kind of leadership to the African community from within the African-American community. And my question is, why isn't there, or are we missing it and there already is?
Well, I think largely you're missing it. I think that we don't all have the same perspectives. For example, you know, Bill Cosby had a statement to say. He certainly didn't speak on behalf of all African-American people. He certainly had the right to say it. But there are plenty of folks, and it truly is a disservice to black people not to realize how many people are out there doing phenomenal work in their communities, within educational systems, within systems of government, on every level, yes, they do exist. The problem is, again, we don't know of them. They're not; these are not things that are widely spread. Or if anything, I'd like to get the word out that they do exist, and to encourage the multiplication of these individuals around the country. They do exist, and they are fostering positive and wonderful programs throughout this country.
The book is called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, America's Legacy of Enduring Injury and Healing. Joy DeGruy-Leary will be speaking about it tomorrow at the White Privilege Conference on the UMSL campus here in St. Louis. Thanks for your time this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joy DeGruy-Leary here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.